Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the podcast. And I'm Gary Bain. I'm here with the wonder that is Peter Hart.
Hello.
You're feeling a bit pathetic today, Pete.
Feeling down in the dumps.
Oh, dear.
It's what you just told me.
Oh, dear. Well, this will soon bring you out of being down in the dumps, or perhaps it won't, actually, because today we're going to be talking about the Battle of Gully Ravine on or about, close enough, 28th of June, 1915.
Yeah, we better set the scene for it. We've done a podcast on the battle that preceded it. That was the third Battle of Krithia, Gary, which was in itself followed up from, guess what?
The second Battle of Krithia,
which
yeah.
was after...
There was a first Battle of Krithia, but that seems to be overlooked.
Nobody knows about that. So after the third Battle of Krithia on the 4th of June, Helles was just... It was just... a complete stalemate. They just seemed to be... Both sides couldn't make any headway. Both sides just seemed to be stuck on this minute 3 miles by 3 miles or 3 by 4 miles peninsula without any bloody hope whatsoever. I mean...
So why didn't they pull out? What did the Germans think at that point?
Germans?
Generals. What did the German generals think?
Well, there were. Very good point, Gary, he said, rescuingly.
Save me, Pete, save me.
Lehmann von Saunders, the German general. They're just basically holding the ring at this point. They've decided to stop laughing at holding the ring. They're just basically holding their positions. But the British generals and the French... So who are the British general?
Our friend, Sir Aylmer Hunter Weston, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he's commanding the British 8th Corps, I think.
And what rank is he then?
I think he's Lieutenant General, isn't he?
He is. And what rank had he been just a year and 3 months before?
Oh, I think it was a Lieutenant Colonel.
And that's amazing.
Actually, that's a great point, isn't it? That's just 12 months.
Yep, 12 and a bit months. Your maths is as good as mine sometimes. And who was the French general?
The French general was Henri Girard, who commanded the Corps Expeditionnaire d'Orient.
Oh, dear. And the two of them and Hamilton behind them, because the overall commander is, of course, the Middle Eastern Expeditionary Force, and that is General Sir Ian Hamilton, who we all know.
Never heard of him.
That's the spirit. And the three generals firmly believe that they had to maintain a continuous pressure on the Turks. And they come up, they realise they can't make another general advance. And they come up with something else. And that is basically what another old friend of yours, Sir Henry Rawlinson, back in on the Western Front, was actually feeling his way towards at this time, this very time after the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle. And this is a type of bite and hold. Bite and hold.
Well, bite and hold? Yeah. Hang on a minute. Have they got the artillery for that? Have they got the shells for that? Don't forget, in other podcasts we've mentioned, they're right in the middle of a shell shortage. How do they do that then?
It's 1915. Well, they're going to try their best to do bite and hold. Bite and hold is based entirely around around artillery. But what they decide is they concentrate all possible, and that's the problem. All that's possible.
It might not be enough, but it's everything they've got.
Yeah. To support very localised attacks. And their idea is to bite off a small chunk of the Turkish line, a distinct small chunk, and then use basically a wall of shells to help the infantry hold off the inevitable Turkish counterattacks, because the Turks have got the German-style policy of counterattacking at all costs. Guess who the British gave the honour of trying out these new tactics?
That would be the French.
Tears, Gaziana, and enjoy every minute of it. And what they do, they do try it. 21st of June, they attack. Now, where they attack is they're on the right of the British line, the position of honour and the most dangerous position, of course, with being fired at from all sides across the strait. They are facing the Kerem's Dere valley, and in front of them they have the Harrico and Quadrilateral redoubts, which dominate the Kerem spur. We will put a map up of this, and they we've talked about this. We did a podcast on the French, and that on the 21st of June they concentrate all their artillery, every bloody gun, every shell they can. They blast their way forward, and they do take the Harrico redoubt. They don't take the Quadrilateral, but they do take the Harrico. And is this painless, Gary?
No, I mean, it's a great success.
It is a great
success. Over 2,500 killed and wounded, Pete.
So, like most bite and hold actions, and this is true of the Western Front at all, it's an extremely painful... It's almost the worst form of attritional warfare in some ways. People don't realise it's grinding your way forward. It's then the turn of the British 29th Division. Now, that had been commanded by Hunter Weston, but it's now commanded by somebody else. And this is a name to run off the tongue. Who is it, Gary?
Yeah, it sounds as if he's actually in command of the wrong bar. He's in the wrong army. His name's Major General Beauvoir de Lille.
Beauvoir de Lille.
Mm.
I wonder if his aunt's pen is in the garden.
Cool. Now, they try a narrow front assault, don't they, on the left flank of Helles on the 28th of June.
And that's what we're talking about today. So that's what this is about. So where are they going? Well, look at your map, and they're going to attack... It's got two phases. First phase, they're going to attack on Fir Tree Spur, the formidable Boomerang Redoubt, and the H-12 trenches. That's on Fir Tree Spur. Then along the Gully Spur, that's next to the sea, between Gully Ravine and the sea, they're going to attack a series of five trenches. And they number back, Gary, from J-9, that's the nearest to the front line, back to J-13, which is level with what you would call the Nuri-Yamut Memorial. It wasn't there then, of course. But that gives you a good picture. They were also going to attack up the Gully Ravine, which is in between the Fir Tree Spur and Gully Spur. And they wanted to reach where the Nullah tributary joins the main gully. And that is where we walk down from Nuri-Yamut. Sorry, that doesn't help the rest of them, does it?
No.
Sorry, other people. You could all bugger off for a minute while I give Gary a personal...
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah, and you can see it on the map. It's the main tributary joins the main gully, if you see what I mean. Now, what artillery support do they get, Gary? You're worried about the artillery support.
Well,
what have they got?
Well, they're supported by some 77 guns or howitzers, and by dint of expending something approaching half the total of British ammunition supply at Helles, they managed to fire just over 16,000 rounds during the battle.
And that's the whole battle.
Now, you and I have had this conversation because... Whilst that's a lot, if you equate that to what's happening on the Western Front, certainly later in the war, it doesn't sound a lot, but it's half of what they've got available.
It's bugger all, to use a highly technical army term.
I recognise that.
And it's well short of what's required for. I mean, they've condensed the area of attack, but have they made it condensed it enough? Have they made it... the frontage short enough? That's the question. And the answer is no, they hadn't. And what they do is they concentrate most of the guns in what they consider the most important part. Now, that's the Gully Spur. That's the left between the sea and the ravine, and the ravine itself. The attack on the H-12 trenches on Fir Tree Spur, that's going to be an afterthought. And so they do not put as many guns on there. Now, Hunter Weston, he's not stupid. He points out that this is not right. And this is a quote from his
Commander Royal Artillery.
Yeah, who is he?
Brigadier General Sir Hugh Simpson Bakey from HQ 8th Corps.
And he says this: before the action, the Corps commander sent for me to say that he did not consider that enough guns and ammunition had been allotted to this portion of the Turkish trenches. I replied that I agreed, but that there were no more available, and that to reduce the bombardment of the hostile trenches on the left of our front would gravely prejudice the success of the 29th Division in that quarter, and that I understood success there was more vital than on the right flank. After consultation with the General Officer commanding 29th Division, the Corps commander, that's Hunter Weston, agreed with my allotment of the artillery. We then did our utmost to obtain the loan of more guns from the French without success. The French probably didn't want to move them right away across to the left flank. They were normally pretty cooperative. Now, this is interesting to me and you, because that is the decision that is going to cost the lives of the 52nd Division who attack on that fir tree spur, and which we're going to have a lot of very emotive quotes. And if you want to know why those men died, were wounded, were tormented by what happened, that's the reason. That's where it originates, in that decision. These men are the men who took that decision. Did they have much choice? What do you think?
No, not a lot, really. Now, Brigadier General William Marshall, who was commanding the assault in 87th Brigade, he did, however, request French assistance to eradicate a Turkish redoubt, which was positioned on the right of Gully Ravine, which would enfilade the advance of his men along Gully Spur.
That is the Boomerang Redoubt. Now, that's very obvious where that is. We've been there, and it's in an open field now, but you can still just about see where it was. And what's interesting is, from there, you can see all across the Gully Ravine, and you can see all across the Gully Spur. So this is important. And you're going to be Brigadier General William Marshall, headquarters 87 Brigade, who explains this better than ever I could.
The divisional orders for the attack reached me on the 26th, and curiously enough, omitted all mention of the Boomerang Redoubt, which would enfilade our projected attack at close range. I represented this, but was told that, if my brigade were successful in taking the trenches, the Boomerang would ipso facto fail.
Fall.
To this I replied that would no doubt be the case, but a great many of my own men would also fall. Eventually, it was arranged that we should take the Boomerang 5 minutes before 0 hour. A trench mortar, nicknamed La Demoiselle, was lent to us by General Durell, and this, under charge of a French Sioux officer, duly arrived and was dug in such a position that it could pump its death-dealing bombs, 100-pound melanite bombs, bang into the dangerous Boomerang Redoubt. The Sioux officer was most particular about the emplacement for La Demoiselle and about arrangements for his own protection. As he very wisely said, elle est bonne, mais très, très dangereuse.
Wonderful pronunciation. Wonderful. Now, as it happens, Marshall is also responsible for something that I think you found quite fascinating. He was responsible for the what ends up as the red triangle symbol of the 29th Division. Because when they attacked, they were given strange pieces of tin cut in the shape of an equilateral triangle with sides about 12 inches long. Now, you're going to be Marshall again from 87th Brigade. Now, tell us what happens. How do you invent this, Gary? Oh, sorry, William. Sorry.
I was down talking to General Breeks, who's the CRA 29th Division, at his observation post, when a discussion arose as to the best means of distinguishing the trenches occupied by our men, when we had made an advance and taken trenches from the enemy. The system of the infantry carrying forward screens, khaki on the side towards the enemy and red on the side towards our guns, had been a failure, because in many cases the Turks had recaptured trenches by counterattack, The men in charge of the screens had been killed and the screens left in position or otherwise utilised by the enemy. Looking from Breek's observation post, our trenches were well defined by a line of shimmering empty ration tins at the back of them. I therefore suggested that instead of carrying screens or flags, each man should carry a piece of tin in his haversack. And these tin discs could be flashed from newly won trenches. The idea was taken up and improved on. In future, each man in the attacking line carried a triangular piece of tin on his back. This method proved of immense value to our gunners during all our further attacks, the flashing line of tin being perfectly visible at ranges when the men themselves were indistinguishable.
And that's where the triangle symbol came from. I think they wore smaller ones on the Somme, actually. So what's happening next? Well, we're up to the point of the bombardment. Now, first of all, the French mortar, La Demoiselle, opens up at 6 o'clock on the 28th of June. And there may have been more than one of them, by the way. And they certainly make their mark on the Boomerang Redoubt. And I'm going to be Petty Officer F.W. Johnson. Sorry to be formal, Gary, but you know how it is.
And petty.
And sorry to be petty as well, yes. But, Gary, you've often complained about my petty nature. I'm of the Royal Naval Air Service. He's a machine gunner. And he says this. The first of these torpedoes was fired at 6 a.m. Its flight was easy to follow and was wonderfully fascinating, reaching a height of perhaps 200 feet and then appearing to be directly overhead. It slowly turned over and still more slowly, it seemed, began to descend. It almost imperceptibly drew away from us and landed with a dull thud on the outer works of the Boomerang. A remarkable silence followed, and then tons of earth, sections of entanglements, bodies, clothes and limbs were sent into the sky. A terrific explosion of unparalleled violence, causing the earth upon which we stood to tremble and spreading its pungent fumes like a mist over everything and everybody. That was the result. Its terrifying roar re-echoed along the ravine until drowned by the ship's guns at sea. Before the air was clear, another torpedo was fired. Wow, wow. And that's going on for 2 or 3 hours, isn't it? And then at 9 o'clock, the main bombardment from the heavy guns. Now, we haven't got many heavy guns. I want to make that clear. They begin to fire and their shells start to fall on the Turkish lines on Gully Spur. The field artillery, they would open up at 10:20.
Along with the support ships.
Destroyers mostly, I think they were. And this raises a sort of pall of yellow dust.
A pall of yellow dust.
A pall, Gary. I pulled that in deliberately.
Now, that covers the whole battlefield, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And you're going to be Petty Officer F.W. Johnston again. And he says this.
For an hour and a half, they sent death itself into the enemy positions. Parapet after parapet went into the air, accompanied by bodies and rags. The air became so thick that at the close of the bombardment, to see a yard in any direction was impossible. It reminded me of a London fog, green in places to a shade of brown. I've never seen a London fog green to brown, but that was probably during the smog days before we were born.
Yeah. Now, the concentration of such resources as were available onto such a tightly controlled target.
Just the Boomerang, this is mainly. Yeah.
I mean, it does lead to success. The bombardment lifted at 10:45, and as Marshall had planned, the Boomerang Redoubt was rushed by the 1st Border Regiment.
And you're going to be one of them. You're going to be Private Sidney Evans of the 1st Borders. What does he say?
At 10:40 a.m, we were ordered to fix bayonets, and the artillery resorts to rapid fire, thus redoubling the fury of the bombardment. High explosive and shrapnel shell is now falling in a veritable howl onto the enemy's trenches, and it seems impossible that any of them can live through it. One more minute and the word "Ready!" is passed along. In that 1 minute, we unconsciously take one look at the sun and the sea and involuntarily commend our bodies and souls to our Maker. And then, before we realise it, a hoarse shout of "Over!" and we are up the ladders and racing like the wind for the redoubt, about 800 yards distant. No sooner are we over than a tremendous burst of rifle and machine gun fire meets us. Here and there, a man stumbles and falls by the way, but we race on and are soon on the trench. The enemy, however, did not wait, and we find our entry unopposed. Hastily, we set to work to reconstruct the shattered parapet of the trench as far as possible in anticipation of a counterattack.
Wow, now they run straight. They're running from there. Now, what did I say that Petty Officer F.W. Johnson, what did I say he was?
He's part of the machine gun team.
He was, and he done half have a good time. It's sad for the Turks, but for him, it's a great moment. He says this, "My gun, trained on the main boomerang sap, now found a target. Dozens and dozens of Turks in their endeavours to get away rush from the redoubt to the cliff side and incidentally into the fire of my gun. Three belts were hurriedly got through before the khaki of our own troops came in pursuit, showing that the boomerang was in our hands." Now, that's been a great success. So this is the preliminary attack just to take the boomerang that is just above the gully ravine eastern side, and so that they can't fire into the attack on the other side of the gully. But now they're going to have the main attack. So when's that set for?
Well, the main attack went in at 11 o'clock. And
who's watching?
General Sir Ian Hamilton was watching from an observation post, which was set back from the battlefield. Now, he found the triangles and an enchanting vista.
He always was a man with a poetic bent.
He was. And General Sir Ian Hamilton says this, "The spectacle was extraordinary. From my post, I could follow the movements of every man. One moment, after 11 a.m, the smoke pall lifted and moved slowly on with 1,000 sparkles of light in its wake, as if someone had quite suddenly flung a big handful of diamonds onto the landscape. Now, as the 1st Border Regiment consolidated in the boomerang, they had a rather closer view of the main 87th Brigade attack on Gully Spur."
Well, we've been there. It's just a matter of 100 yards.
Yeah,
just,
you can
just
see quite clearly. Now, this is Private Sidney Evans of the 1st Border Regiment. And
so he's in the boomerang.
He's in the boomerang, and he says this, "Wave after wave of khaki-clad troops sweep over their trenches and rush one Turkish trench after another. Behind come the supports marching in a steady, unwavering line with sloped arms, their bayonets glittering in the sunlight. It's a fine sight, and we give them an encouraging cheer as they pass our position. The enemy artillery now switch their artillery fire onto this advancing line, but with little effect. Gaps occur here and there as the shrapnel mows its way through them, but they close up as if on parade and steadily advance onwards."
Now, the bombardment, I mean, what impact do you think it's had on the Turks in those J trenches, you know, 9, 10, 11?
Well, they're not going to be in any sort of fit state to put up any prolonged resistance. And you know, the first two lines of trenches are actually captured relatively easily.
So the 87th Brigade does done well. And then the 86th Brigade comes through, leapfrogs through them. It's all quite modern, isn't it? But then it makes more progress. But then the Turks counterattack, as they always will do. One weapon in particular is evident. What would that be?
Well, the Turks themselves attack with a considerable vigour, Pete, but it's behind a hail of bombs. They are held off and the captured lines are secured. And Private Daniel Joyner, who was in the second wave with the 1st King's Own Scottish Borderers, as they went forward into the attack, says this, and you're going to be Private Daniel Joyner.
"While waiting beneath the parapet, it was torture." This is a classic going over the top business again. "Hell, the sensations felt going over the parapet, expected to be hit anywhere, awful. But as soon as you realise you're over safe, you lose all such thoughts and feelings. Mad. But men are falling right and left. They're hardly noticed. One thought only exists, the first trench. It is almost impossible to remember afterwards whether you walked, ran, crawled or flew." I bet he didn't fly. "Over the intervening ground. The South Wales Borderers have reached the first line and are engaging the enemy. We are soon with them and materially assist them. Allah, Allah, the Turk cries as he puts his hand up, while another tries to bury himself in the ground out of reach of our bayonets. Others kneel and fire until their magazine is discharged. Then they try and run away. They are soon all accounted for, and the first line is ours." There's a grimness about that.
Yeah,
taking many prisoners, do you think?
No, I don't. It doesn't sound like it, does it? Now, on their left flank, the four battalions of the 29th Indian Brigade, which is commanded by Brigadier General Herbert Cox, were attacking along the beach and cliffs on the left of the Galley Spur.
Now, I want to make a bit of a fuss about this, but sadly, I've got no quotes. I really did look. I looked in Stanley's book. I looked in the regimental histories, but there just aren't quotes about it. But this is quite a major achievement, because what happens in the first assault, the 2nd 10th Gurkha Rifles, they do brilliantly, Gary. They advance in that area between the sea. Those gullies and hills between the top of the cliff and the sea, they go 1,000 yards. And there's photographs, I might put one up, of you in that sort of ground. You don't look as if you could go 1,000 yards, Gary. It's a hell of achievement. They capture several Turkish lines, and they get as far as Fusilier Bluff, which is where the Nuriyama Memorial is. Again, I'm sorry to keep using it. I'll explain it a bit later. And then they followed up. Who follows them up?
The 1st, 5th, or the 1st, 6th Gurkha Rifles following them up. They wheel right, and then again, they push towards the Nala tributary in the Gully Ravine.
Now, so overall, what would you say about the attack on the along Gully Spur?
Well, it sounds relatively successful, I think, given the conditions and everything that could be expected.
Now, how's it going to be for 156 Brigade of 52nd Division? Now, they're attacking the H trenches, H12 in particular, on Fir Tree Spur. Now, these are the ones that aren't going to have quite so much artillery, if any, supporting them. I mean, there's bugger all for them, isn't it? And we've chosen, it's tracking along with my book on Gallipoli, we've chosen one battalion because the witness that from that battalion seems to sum it up, doesn't he? What it is the battalion is the 1st 8th Scottish Rifles. And Gary, you're going to be Major James Findlay. Now, you've just taken over command.
Yeah, the week before.
And you've got an inexperienced battalion. They've only just arrived at Gallipoli, and they're attacking on that front. And you're going to read a series of extracts, and I think it's emotionally quite heartrending for this poor officer seeing his battalion destroyed. But you're going to tell the story.
Major James Findlay, 1st 8th Scottish Rifles. I do not think that many of us got much sleep. I know that to me the night was slow in passing. But dawn came at last, cool and beautiful, with a hint of the coming heat, and the dried-up sparse scrub had been freshened by the night's dewfall. One was impressed by the good heart of all ranks, but whether it was premonition or merely the strain of newly acquired responsibility, I could not feel the buoyancy of anticipated success. I remember going round the line in the early morning and finding that there was some difficulty about the planks which the supported reserve companies had to put across the front trenches to facilitate passage. But these eventually arrived in time. The artillery bombardment, which took place from 0900 to 1100, was, even to a mind then inexperienced in a real bombardment, quite too futile. But it drew down upon us, naturally, a retaliatory shelling. How slowly these minutes from 10:55 to 11 passed. Centuries of time seemed to go by. One became conscious of saying the silliest things, all the while painfully thinking, it may be the last time I shall see these fellows alive. Prompt, at 11 o'clock, the whistles blew.
Now, I really like this chap's writing. I think he sums it up beautifully. That's a lovely bit of writing. That really sets the scene before they go over the top. His men go over. Remember, he's a colonel. No, well, he's acting colonel. He's a major. But he stays back in the trenches. What happens to his men? They get hit by just a devastating stream of fire from all sides, basically. And Findlay realises the attack's breaking down in no man's land. So he's sent back to brigade for reinforcements, and then he moves forward, moving up a sap with his adjutant. Now, his adjutant's called Captain Charles Bramwell. We'll be mentioning these names, so I'm going through them. And he also has with him his signal officer, someone I particularly want you to note, because he's a brave lad, and it's quite sad as well what happens to him, Lieutenant Tom Stout. And those three together, the command of the battalion, are going forward to try and establish a forward headquarters. Now, they don't really get very far. Do you think their ranks any defence against bullets, Gary?
Not at all, and Major James Findlay says, Bramwell and I then pushed our way up the sap, which for a short distance concealed us, but got shallower as we went along, until first our heads, then our shoulders, and then the most of our bodies were exposed. We soon arrived at Patterson's bombing party, which I had sent up this sap. He'd been killed, and those of his men that were left were lying flat. They could not get on as the sap rose a few yards in front of them to the ground level, and the leading man was lying in only about 18 inches of cover. In any case, they were still some 50 yards from the enemy trenches. Bullets were spattering all around us, and we seemed to bear charmed lives, until, just as we arrived at the rear of this party, Bramwell fell at my side, shot through the mouth. He said not a word, and I'm glad to think that he was killed outright. I made up my mind that the only thing to be done was to collect what men there were and make a dash for it. I told this to Stout, and stooping down to pick up a rifle, I was shot in the neck. At the moment, I didn't feel much, but when I saw the blood spurt forward, I supposed that it had got my jugular vein. I stuck a handkerchief round my neck and tried to get on, but I was bowled over by a hit in the shoulder. I tumbled back over some poor devil and for a minute or two tried to collect myself. Up came young Stout and said, "I'm going to try to carry you back, sir," but I wouldn't let him.
I think this is just a marvellous bit. I mean, there he is trying to organise. He's not, when he says he's going to make a rush, he's going to make a rush forward that last 50 yards. When he's wounded, shot through the throat, thinks it's got his jugular, probably hasn't, but I mean, it's still bleeding like buggery. And he's still trying to get on until he's hit again. Anyway, and also the courage of young Stout, you know, I'll carry you back, sir. But then he says no, because he realised that Stout's needed. He's the signal officer. Anyway, everyone around him can see that he's badly wounded. But Findlay's just, what's in his mind?
Well, he's obsessed with the idea that he's got to re-establish his forward headquarters and coordinate the next stage of the attack. And in the end, Tom Stout simply ignores him, and Major James Findlay says this: "I told Stout to send another runner for reinforcements. A few minutes later, he came back and took me by the shoulders, and some other good fellow lifted me by the feet, and together they got me back some 10 yards. And though a bullet got me in the flesh of the thigh, I was now comparatively sheltered, while they were still exposed. It was then that a splinter of shell blew off Tommy Stout's head, and the other man was hit simultaneously. Gallant lads, God rest them."
It's funny, just going through this now, it makes me, we must go and look at, I presume he hasn't got a grave, Stout, but we must look at him on the Hellas Memorial. I know that doesn't do anybody any good, but I just think this story just resonates with me. It really does. What a brave chap Stout was. Good for him. Anyway, Findlay himself is brave. He manages to stagger back to the lines. And what state are you in, Gary? Just give me an idea of what state you're in.
Well, let's bear in mind he's now been hit 3 times, although he described the last one as just a minor flesh wound. He's in a really dreadful state by now. He's either very lucky or unlucky, depending on one's viewpoint, because he's suffered some 7 major wounds, as well as a liberal sprinkling of minor scrapes from bomb fragments. Now, his battalion, they've suffered over 400 casualties, and 25 of the 26 officers had been hit.
Not good percentage chances if you're an officer in that battalion, then.
No, not good at all, is it?
And I just want to say that if you or I suffered one of those minor scrapes with a bomb fragment...
One.
I think just one of them.
One.
I think we'd be moaning.
Yeah.
You, of course, never moan. So you'd be...
I'd be commenting on them.
You'd be commenting on it, whereas I'd be moaning.
But think about his own words there. He mentions the 3 gunshot wounds he gets, the one to the throat, the one to the shoulder, the one to the thigh. He doesn't even mention anything else. And he's got 7 injuries.
It's and also just 400 casualties. And I know we joke about the Scots a lot. But what happened to these Scottish battalions of the 52nd Division is outrageous. It is terrible. And we've been in that field. I've taken you across that field, so to speak. And we've stood there, and we've often walked up Gully Ravine, and we're a little bit tired and footsore by then. We have to walk across that field towards the big cemetery, the name of which won't come to me just at the moment. Mm. And when you think of, we're a bit tired, just compare it to those poor lads that day. It's beyond belief. But that's pretty well what happens to everybody in 156 Brigade, isn't it?
Yeah, there's high casualties. There are some minor gains on the left.
Well, I've got a story, haven't I, of one where they get to the second line. This is Lieutenant Leslie Grant, and he's in the 4th Royal Scots. And he says this. This is a graphic one. Close your ears at times in this. And also, it's just bloody horrible at times. He says this. Bob yelled, "Come on, boys!" I gave him a leg up, and Jimmy Fleck shoved me up just at his heels. When we got up over the parapet, my platoon were practically enfiladed. The air seemed thick with bullets. I remember thinking the puffs of sand all around were awfully funny. The platoon started going too much to the left. I yelled to them to keep to the right, but I hardly heard my own voice for the row. I want you to note, by the way, I think there's this element of hysteria throughout this interview that comes out. And I don't blame him, by the way, but the gap between my platoon and D Company on the right got rapidly wider. I dashed off to the right, thinking that they would follow. I crossed an old trench and then saw the Turkish trench, perhaps 20 yards further on. Looked round and I suddenly realised I was all alone. C and D Companies were perhaps 150 yards apart and I was about midway between. I think perhaps some cells of one's brain must be numb because I don't seem to have had the slightest sense of danger at any time. It reminded me of nothing so much as a football match, the thrill of a good dribble up the field. I reached the Turkish trench and found it almost battered to pieces. Further along on either side, it wasn't so bad and there were a lot of Turks about, putting up a good fight. By the mercy of Providence, I had struck a bit which was almost obliterated. I sank in almost to my knees in the soft earth. The place was in a fearful mess. Blood everywhere. Arms, legs, entrails lying around. There was only one man who tried to put up a fight, although what looked like an officer badly wounded tried to get me with his revolver. It sounds horrible in cold blood, but this time, all that is savage in one seemed to be on top. I remember two things distinctly. One was wanting to cut off a man's ears and keep them as a trophy. The other was jumping on the dead, hacking their faces with my feet or crashing my rifle into them. Looking along to my left, I saw dozens of our men. They came on to within a yard or two of the trench, seemed to hesitate, then dashed into it. Men fought with their rifles, their feet, their bare fists, a pick, a shovel, anything. But the orders had been given, go for the second trench, never mind the first. So it was on again. I scrambled out. Something seemed to force me on and I started running again. We'll have to leave his story later on. They don't manage to hold the second line, but they do make some progress. But that fighting, how raw is that? And how strangely the hysteria in what he describes, he quite frankly describes as well.
Yeah, shocking. Now, on Fir Tree Spur, the artillery preparation had not been anywhere near as devastating as on Gully Spur, although the 1st, 4th and 1st, 7th Royal Scots managed to reach the Turks' second line to their right. As we've seen, the 1st, 8th Scottish Rifles were ripped to shreds by heavy machine gun fire.
So on the left, near the gully, the 1st, 4th and 1st, 7th make a bit of progress, yeah. But yeah, on the right, for our 1st, 8th Scottish, that's the one you were in Findlay, were you, isn't it? Yeah. Now, the Brigade Reserve Forward go forward. The 1st, 7th Scottish Rifles, did they do any better?
Well, they fared a little better, but only a few of them reach the Turkish front line before, inevitably, they're driven back.
Now, they make further efforts throughout the day, but even when 88th Brigade from 29th Division tries to help, nothing else is achieved. And eventually they consolidate the very minor gains they've made on the right-hand section, on the Fir Tree Spur. Attempts by the 1st Dublin Fusiliers to attack up Gully Ravine, they meet with a bit of success, and they eventually get a front line. It's weird, it bends from Fusilier Bluff right across about 100 yards in front of the nullah, till it meets the Gully Ravine. It's sort of diagonally across the spur in the strangest manner. And then it links, then it crosses Gully Ravine and links onto the bits of H-12 that had been captured by 1st, 4th Royal Scots. Now, the men of the King's Own Scottish Borderers, they've then got an unpleasant task. What's that?
Well, they're ordered to clear out Gully Ravine of the, and I'm using these words as an alternative, tangled detritus of war.
Mm.
Yeah.
Proves
now, it proves an unforgettable task. And Private Daniel Joyner of 1st King's Own Scottish Borderers says this.
Oh, well, you're not going to like this. This is not nice as well. Both sides of the gully were lined with what had been Turkish shelters. They were in appearance like a farmhouse outhouse. They were still shelters, but not for live Turks. As we proceeded down the gully, we had to drag the dead bodies into them to make room for the traffic. Further down, pools of stagnant water with green, evil-smelling slime had to be passed. We used to have great fun going up the gully trying to push people in there, if you remember. Mm. Often the skeleton of some unknown soldier floated on the top. That's not so funny, is it? The dead had to be disposed of. There were too many to bury, and it was not sanitary. Cremation was decided upon. Each sergeant with 12 men was instructed to prepare a fire from the wood of the Turkish shelters. The bodies, after being searched, were then put on it. What a nice, pleasant job. Count had to be kept of the number cremated. One head, two arms, one body and two legs to count as one man. The sun was already having its effect on them. Respirators had to be worn. That's because of the stench of the corpses. All scruples had to be laid aside and just get on with it. Steady there. Don't lose that leg. It's only hanging on by the trousers. Bring that head here. That completes another man. Yep, bring that leg. We only want a body now to make another man. The fires blazed upon the ground of Gully Ravine. So hot did the fires get, we were forced to put sand on. It's too hot now to place them on, so we throw them on. We have luckily forgotten we're human beings. It's just awful, awful. And we've been in that valley. We know exactly where all this took place. It's in between, well, the Boomerang and where the front line ends at Border Redoubt, it became called. What were the Turks doing? What would they do?
Well, they're busy counterattacking on Gully Spurpeat. The series of trenches running across the spur and into the Nulla tributary were a scene of murderous fighting as the Turks used their superior bombs to try and blast the British and Indian troops out.
So we're still using improvised jam tins mainly. What is the approach to the Turks adopt in attacking?
Well, they're almost careless of casualties.
They're careless of everything,
yeah. And the Turks continue to launch massed attacks out of the Nulla across Gully Spur.
So this isn't subtle at all. This is just massed.
No.
Weight of numbers.
No. And we've mentioned before that the Turkish troops were really good in defence.
They were.
But they had the same approach when attacking. And they're almost...
As the British, you mean?
Yeah, they're almost callous of their own men in the attack. And they're coming across Gully Spur and down Gully Ravine. And once more, you're going to be Private Joyner because he and his company are ordered forward to support the South Wales border on the front line.
And I'm joined, as you said, Private Daniel Joyner, 1st KOSB, and he says this, on they came, he means the Turks, crowd after crowd. The machine guns were mowing them down. Those who managed to gain the open were under fire from the infantry of either flank. The Ross Battery, and one of our friends, Rob Langham's great-grandfather was in Ross Battery, was paying attention to the Turkish reinforcements, which were being hurried up. They persevered with this mad attack until 4 a.m. next morning. What had they gained? Nothing but a small trench they'd succeeded in digging about 200 yards in front of us. At what cost? To them, 1,000 lives. To us, an enormous amount of ammunition, a night's sleep and a few lives. That's the soldier's attitude. I'm all right.
Although shortly afterwards, he was Private Daniel Joyner's wounded in the leg and he's evacuated.
That's the end of his campaign. In my book, Gallipoli, he's quite a character. You may remember, Gary, he features a lot in the accounts of the Y Beach landings. A very interesting chap. Now, The next story is you're going to be Second Lieutenant Roy Laidlaw of the 1st Royal Munster Fusiliers. Now, this story is about the death of Sergeant Victor Rathfield. He was a South African who was serving with the 1st Munsters. And what interests me about this story is the responsibility you as Laidlaw feel for his death. Yeah, you can clearly see it's not really his fault, but it's a lifelong thing for him.
Sergeant Rathfelder came along to me and asked in a voice harsh with thirst, "Can I go and get water, sir?" The Turks attacked twice more, and then about 3 a.m, Rathfelder returned, a pick handle over one shoulder. From it dangled 9 water bottles filled with water. He put them beside me, saying, "The boys will be glad of that, sir. Thanks, Rathfelder. Now get some rest behind the Parados." He turned away, and as he did so, I saw 2 more men shot down in the trench and shouted out, "Send 2 more men into the trench!" The sergeant halted to catch the order, which rose faintly above the surrounding din, and then pitched forward, shot through the head, splattering me with his blood and brains. To this day, I blame myself bitterly for having spoken those words.
So, Rathfield heard him shout the order.
Stopped and turned.
Just stopped, yeah. And just picked off. Oh, that's terrible. Now, the Turks, they're really bothered by this. And if you think of the way, it does mean, because the Nuri Memorial, which marks the end at Fusilier Bluff, that is almost level with Carinthia. This is a serious advance that the Indians, because it's them mainly, have made. So what do the Turks do? It's not just that an immediate counterattack. They order repeated counterattacks from their 3rd and 5th divisions over the next few days. And when's the final effort come?
Final effort comes at dawn on the 5th of July after a weak preliminary bombardment.
Now, this is a good point. Well made by you. Because that's something they shared. They don't have much artillery or ammunition either, do they?
They launched a simultaneous attack all along the line.
In that area.
Amongst those opposing them was Lieutenant Colonel Guy Geddes.
Lieutenant Colonel, but I thought he was a captain, Gary, when he landed.
He was.
A month before.
It's a long time in war, isn't it? He'd recovered from his shoulder wound, which he suffered during the V Beach landing, and he found himself in command of the Munster Fusiliers holding Worcester Flats trenches. And Lieutenant Colonel Guy Geddes, 1st Royal Munster Fusiliers, says this: "The men appeared in particularly good form, and the companies in reserve came rushing up to participate and started squabbling with each other to get a shot in. It was really ridiculous, and the trenches, of course, far too congested. The attack fizzled out at 0600, a hopeless failure. One peculiar incident was that of a Turk who caught fire and was a living torch lighting up in the dim light, his comrades nearby. A good many Turks, unable to get back to their trenches, lay in the scrub between our lines, but with some judicious shrapnel, were flushed like birds to be brought down by our snipers."
Yes.
That's so, quite matter-of-fact, isn't it, for what he's talking about?
It is matter-of-fact. He was a good colonel, Geddes. He proved himself a good colonel in action. But promoted very quickly, of course. Very quickly. I mean, captain to lieutenant colonel in... when did they land?
This 25th of April.
So it's six weeks. My maths is terrible.
It's about 19 weeks.
5th of July. Yeah, quite right. Sorry. So that's not quite right. But the point remains... quick promotion in the army. If you'd been at Gallipoli, Gary, you could have gone from private to something like...
Lance Corporal.
Yeah. Would you have been... You'd have been one of the few to be demoted at Gallipoli.
Now, moving on swiftly.
Where's that rum ration?
Moving on swiftly.
Corporal Bain.
On that dreadful day, the Turks would find that bravery was useless against a combination of artillery, machine guns and rapid fire from well-aimed rifles.
Well, that's the essence of it. And thank you for bringing me down to because this is... And this is the thing we've got to look at. It's not just our casualties we have to, in a sense, sort of mourn and reflect on and feel sorry for. There's thousands of Turks are hit in these attacks. Between 28th of June and 5th of July... Those Germans get everywhere, though. The Turks reckon they lost some 14,000 casualties.
That's their own numbers.
That's
huh?
Yeah. That's so about 5,000 dead would that would be. What do you think the ground was like in front of the British trenches? Just imagine it.
Well, certainly, the ground in front of the trenches are covered with a huge number of rotting Turkish corpses. It's awful. I mean, it's really difficult to just talk about that because you get that image in your head. That is awful. And they'd stay there for the rest of the campaign because...
No truce, then?
No, the British steadfastly refused Turkish requests for an armistice for mass burials.
Why?
Well, they imagined that the Turks might be less willing to attack over a no-man's land sprinkled with their rotting dead, frankly.
I think you might be right.
And Hunter Weston decides his men would just have to endure the awful stench.
And someone I interviewed, Thomas Baker, said you could smell Hellas 3 miles off, you know, when you were approaching, because he was coming in as a returned, he'd been wounded and he was brought back, and he said you could smell it 3 miles off.
Now, this will give some context to us keep mentioning the Nuri Yamat memorial, because many of the bodies would only be gathered up and commemorated decades later, when General Nuri Yamat, who was then commanding the 2nd Turkish Corps from about 1943 to 1945, he sold his own house, Pete, to finance the collection of the bones. Apparently, the skulls were like melons in a field.
That's what Bullent told us, and actually, Kenan Celik used to say this as well, yeah.
And the construction of the memorial that still sits at the top of Fusilier Bluff marks the furthest point the Allies ever got at Hellas.
Yeah, we love that place, and not just because that's where we meet the van with the ice cream after long walks. It's a wonderful memorial, in a sense, to all those Turkish lads who were killed, because they're just as important. As important.
They are, and I would heartily recommend, if you want to know a bit more about General Nuri Yamat, you can go away and do some study of him. He's available on the internet. Just Google him. He came to a rather sticky end because he was involved in a seeming coup against the government. But he's a remarkable man, and you should go and perhaps have a look and see what you can find out.
And I'll certainly be thinking about him next time. Well, hopefully in September when we stand there yet again and just look around at a wonderful memorial to all those Turkish lads who lost their lives fighting for their country in their country. Doesn't mean any. You don't have to dislike the other side just because you're interested in your side. Now there are lessons. For the Allied generals in the action of 28th of June, and perhaps you'd like to go through them because you're the man with military experience. What lessons would you take from it?
Well, that you wouldn't want to do it naked.
That's the lesson you take from most things at Gallipoli, Gary.
Now, let's bear in mind it's not just the 28th of June, it's right the way through into July, but one of the main lessons is that they need to focus their attacks.
That's to concentrate their artillery, their limited artillery. It bite and hold does have some future.
Yeah, and they took a lesson from that as well. They above all, they need more artillery.
So, bite and hold is also, at the same time, impossible, as you rightly said earlier, because
they haven't got enough guns or ammunition. But not only artillery, more howitzers. You've described it previously about the trajectory from a howitzer, how that's useful in entrenched positions, and more high explosive shells.
Because shrapnel's not much use to people who are underground.
No.
So the essence is they have to focus their attacks, something like bite and hold, but bite and hold is impossible with the resources they have there. So that's not good lessons.
No, there's also, and you mentioned it earlier, they need more bombs to help counter the Turkish counterattacks. The Turkish were far better equipped.
Their Mills bombs would only arrive very late at Gallipoli. In fact, they're never really used in action.
No.
So they're using improvised bombs and the cricket ball bombs. That's all they've got. None of them were which any good.
Now, Hunter Weston, he sums it up in his report.
What's he say?
This is Lieutenant General Aylmer Hunter Weston, HQ 8th Corps. He says, "It was unavoidable, owing to the shortage of howitzers and ammunition, that the trenches east of the ravine were insufficiently bombarded by howitzer high explosive shell. This was the cause of the failure and the heavy casualties at this point. A complete success yesterday would have required another 8 howitzers and 600 more rounds of ammunition." I'm assuming he's talking about early, the 28th of June, early stages there. When he
it's the 28th of June. He's concentrated on that in his mind.
Yeah.
Now, what did Hamilton think? General Sir Ian Hamilton at GHQ.
Well, he wrote, "Hunt to Weston, Durrell and Braithwaite agree that had we only shelled to repeat our bombardment of this morning, now we could go on another 1,000 yards before dark. Result, Achi Baba tomorrow, or at the latest, the day after."
Oh, that's utter bollocks. I mean, not to mince my words, but that is not the case. The main thing is, it's like saying, Gary, I'd love to give you £1 million.
I'd love you to give me £1 million.
But I haven't got £1 million.
Oh.
I suppose I could sell the flat.
You could.
But the point is, if you haven't got it, you haven't got it. So there's no point.
So at this point, then, presumably, they all just left Gallipoli and
no, it carries on for another 8 months.
So we're going to be back both literally and figuratively at some point.
Oh, Gary, you're so poetic at times. Yeah, we will.
We will. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?